After another moment, Han began to walk around, looking me over one more time. "So, there you have it," he concluded. "The legends say that humans will first learn the true nature of foods and what kinds to consume. Then, the legends say, we can fully open up to the inner sources of energy that increase our vibration even more." He slid his chair back from the table and looked at me. "You are handling the altitude very well here in Tibet, but I would like for you to rest."
"That would be nice," I said. "I'm bushed."
"Yes," Yin agreed. "We have had a long day." "Make sure you expect a dream," Han added, leading me toward a bedroom.
"Expect a dream?" Han turned.
"Yes. You are more powerful than you think."
I laughed.
I woke up suddenly and looked out the window. The sun was well up in the sky. No dream. I put on my shoes and walked into the other room. Han and Yin were sitting at the table, talking. "How did you sleep?" Han asked.
"Okay," I said, slumping down in one of the chairs, "but I can't remember dreaming."
"That's because you don't have enough energy," he said, half distracted. He was staring intensely at my body again. I realized he was focused on the way I was sitting.
"What are you looking at?" I asked.
"Is this the way you wake up in the morning?" Han inquired.
I stood up.
"What's wrong?" "After sleep, one must wake up one's body and begin to accept the energy before one does anything else." He was standing with his legs far apart and his hands on his hips. As I watched, he slid his feet together and lifted his arms. His body rose up in one motion until he was standing on his tiptoes with his palms pressed together directly over his head. I blinked. There was something unusual about the way his body moved, and I couldn't focus on it exactly. He seemed to float upward rather than use his muscles. When I could focus again, he was beaming a broad smile. Just as quickly, his body moved from there into a graceful walk toward me. I blinked again. "Most people wake up slowly," Han said, "and slouch around and get themselves going with a cup of coffee or tea. They go to a job in which they continue to slouch around or use just one particular set of muscles. Patterns set in, and as I said, blocks develop in the way energy flows through our bodies. You must make sure your body is open everywhere in order to receive all the energy that is available. You do this by moving every muscle every morning from your center." He pointed to a place just below his navel. "If you concentrate on moving from this area, then your muscles will be free to operate at their highest level of coordination. It is the central principle of all the martial arts and dance disciplines. You can even invent your own movements." With this comment, he launched into a multitude of movements I had never seen before. It appeared to be something like the shifts of weight and the twirling that one sees in Tai Chi. He was definitely performing an expansion of these classical movements. "Your body," he added, "will know how to move in order to help loosen your individual blocks." He stood on one leg and leaned over and swung his arm as if he were pitching a softball underhanded, only his hand almost touched the floor as he made the movement. Then he spun around in place on the opposite leg. I never saw his weight shift, and again he seemed to be floating. I shook my head and tried to focus, but he had stopped in place as if a photographer had frozen his movements in a snapshot, which appeared impossible. Just as suddenly, he was walking toward me again. "How do you do this?" I asked. He said, "I began slowly and remembered the basic principle. If you move from your center and expect the energy to flow into you, you will move in a lighter and lighter manner. Of course, to perfect this, you must be able to open up to all the divine energy that is available within." He stopped and looked at me. "How well do you remember your mystical opening?" I thought again about Peru and my experience on the mountaintop. "Fairly well, I think."
"This is good," he said. "Let's go outside."
Yin smiled as he got up,
and we followed Han out into a small garden and up some steps into an area of sparse brown grass and large, jagged boulders. The rocks had attractive streaks of reds and browns running through them. For 10 minutes, Han led me through some of the movements I had seen earlier, then offered me a place to sit down on the ground, taking a seat to my right. Yen sat down behind us. The morning sun bathed the mountains in the distance in a warm yellow light. I was struck by their beauty. "The legends say," Han began, "that opening up to a higher energy state is an ability that all humans will eventually acquire. It will begin as a general knowledge that such an awareness is possible. Then we will move to an understanding of all the factors involved in cultivating and maintaining higher levels of energy." He paused and looked at me. "You already know the basic procedure, but your senses must be expanded. The legends say that first you calm yourself and look out on your surroundings. Most of us seldom look closely at the things around us. It's just stuff that takes a back seat to whatever is in our minds to get done. But we must remember that everything in the universe is alive with spiritual energy and is a part of God. We must intentionally ask to connect with the divine inside us. As you know, the measure as to whether we are connecting with this energy is our sense of beauty. Always ask yourself this question: how beautiful everything looks. No matter how it appears at first, we can always see more beauty in it if we try. The degree of beauty we can see measures how much divine energy we are receiving within us. Han went on to have me spend some time looking, really looking, at everything around me. "Once we begin to establish our connection," he said, "and experience the divine energy within, everything begins to have more presence in our perception. Things stand out, and we notice their unique shape and color. When this perception occurs, we can breathe in even more energy. You see, in reality, the energy doesn't come so much from the things around us, although we can absorb energy directly from some plants and sacred sites. Sacred energy comes from our connection to the divine inside us. Everything around us, both natural and man-made, flowers, rocks, grass, mountains, art, is already majestically beautiful and present beyond anything most humans can perceive. All we do when we open up to the divine is raise our energy vibration and thus our perceptual ability so we can view the world the way it already is. Do you understand? Humans already live in a world of immense beauty and color and form. Heaven itself is right here. We just haven't opened up to enough inner energy to see it." I listened with fascination. This was clearer now than ever before. "Focus on the beauty," Han instructed, "and begin to breathe in the energy within you." I took a deep breath. "Now, look for increases in the beauty as you breathe," Han instructed. I gazed out again at the rocks and mountains, and to my amazement, I noticed that the tallest of the ridges in the distance was Mount Everest. For some reason, I hadn't recognized its shape before. "Yes, yes, look at Everest," Han said. As I gazed out at the mountain, I noticed that the snow-rippled ridges on its face seemed to make little steps up toward the crown-shaped peak. The sight jolted my perception outward, and the world's tallest mountain instantly seemed closer. Somehow, part of me, as if I might be able to reach out and touch it. "Keep breathing," Han said. "Your vibration and ability to perceive will increase even more. Everything will become shiny, as though illuminated from within." I took another breath, and I began to feel lighter, and my back straightened with little effort. Unbelievably, I felt exactly as I had during the mountain experience in Peru. Han was nodding. "Your ability to perceive beauty is the primary measure that divine energy is coming into you. But there are other measures as well." "You will feel lighter," Han continued. The energy will rise up through you and lift you up, as you said, like a string pulling you up from the top of your head. And you will feel a greater wisdom about who you are and what you are doing. You will receive intuitions and dreams about what is next on your life path. He paused and looked at my body. I was now sitting up, effortlessly. Now, we come to the most important part, he said. You must learn to sustain this energy, to keep it flowing into you. You must use the power of your expectations here, the power of your prayer energy. Here was this word again, expectation. I had never heard it used in this context before. How do I do that? I asked, feeling confused, my body dropping in energy, the forms and colors around me fading. Han's eyes got large, and he burst into laughter. He tried several times to stop, but finally rolled on the ground in uncontrollable mirth. He regained his composure several times, but began laughing again every time he looked at me. I even heard Yen snickering in the background. Finally, Han managed to take some breaths and calm down. I'm very sorry, he said. It's just that your expression was so funny. You really don't believe you have any power at all, do you? It's not that, I protested. I just don't know what you meant by expectation. Han was still smiling. You do think you carry around certain expectations about life, don't you? You expect the sun to rise. You expect your blood to circulate. Of course. Well, I am only asking that you try to become conscious of these expectations. It is the only way to maintain and extend the higher level of energy that you just experienced. You must learn to expect that level of energy in your life, and you must do so very deliberately and consciously. This is the only way to complete the first prayer extension. Would you like to try again? I smiled back at him, and we spent several minutes breathing and building up the energy. When I was seeing the higher level of beauty I had experienced before, I nodded at him. Now, he said, you must expect this energy that is filling you to keep filling you and to flow out of you in every direction. Visualize this happening. I tried to hold on to my energy level as I asked, this outflow, how do I know this is really happening? You will be able to feel it. Just visualize it for now. I took another breath and visualized the energy coming into me and flowing out in every direction into the world. I still don't know whether it's really happening, I said. Han looked directly at me, appearing slightly impatient. You know the energy is flowing out of you because the energy is maintained. The colors and shapes stay high, and you feel it as it fills you, then overflows outward. How does it feel? I asked. He looked at me with incredulity. You know the answer to that. I gazed out at the mountains again, visualizing the energy flow going out of me toward them. They remained beautiful and began to be immensely attractive as well. Then, a rush of deep emotion filled me, and I remembered what I had experienced in Peru. Han was nodding. Of course, I said. The measure of whether the energy is flowing out is the feeling of love. Han smiled broadly. Yes! It is a love that becomes a background emotion that stays with you as long as your prayer energy is going out into the world. You must stay in a state of love. This seems awfully idealistic for ordinary human beings, I said. Han chuckled. I'm not telling you how to be an ordinary human being. I'm telling you how to be at the edge of evolution. I'm telling you how to be a hero. Just remember that you must expect divine energy to come into you at a higher level and to flow out of you like a cup running over. When you get disconnected, remember this feeling of love. Try to consciously rekindle the state. His eyes twinkled again. Your expectation is the key to whether you can maintain this experience. You must visualize it happening. Believe that it will be there for you in all situations. This expectation must be cultivated and consciously affirmed every day. I nodded. Now, he said, do you understand all the procedures I have told you about? Before I could answer, he said, the key is how you wake up in the morning. That is why I asked you to sleep, so that I could see how you wake up. You must do so with discipline. Wake your body up to the inflow of energy in the manner that I showed you. Move from your center. Feel the energy immediately. Expect it immediately. Eat only the foods that are still alive, and after a while, inner divine energy will be easier to breathe into your being. Take the time to fill up with energy every day and wake up with movement. Remember the measures. Visualize that this energy is coming into you and feel it as it flows out into the world. Do this, and you will have completed the first extension. You will be able not just to experience energy occasionally, but to cultivate it and maintain it at a higher level. He bowed low, and without saying anything else, walked back toward the house. Yen and I followed. When we arrived, Han began selecting food and placing it in a large basket. What about the gateway? I asked Han. He stopped and looked at me. There are many gateways. I mean, do you know where we can find the gateway to Shambhala? He looked at me sternly. You have only completed one extension of your prayer energy. You now must learn what to do with this energy that is flowing out of you. And you are very headstrong and still prone to fear and anger. You will have to overcome these tendencies before you can get anywhere near Shambhala. With that statement, Han nodded at Yen and handed him the basket, and then walked into the other room. 4. Conscious Alertness. I walked out to the Jeep feeling incredibly good. The air was cool, and the mountains in every direction still seemed luminous. We got in the vehicle, and Yin pulled away. Do you know where to go now? I asked. I know that we must head toward northwest Tibet. According to the legends, that is the closest gateway to us. But, as Lama Rigdon said, we will have to be shown. Yin paused and glanced at me. It is time that I told you about my dream. The dream that Lama Rigdon mentioned, I asked, the one you had of me? Yes. In this dream, we are together, journeying across Tibet, looking for the gateway. And we could not find it. We journeyed very far and traveled in circles, lost. But at the moment of our greatest despair, we met someone who knew where we should go. What happened after that? The dream ended. Who was the person? Was it Will? No, I don't think so. What do you think the dream means? It means we must be very alert. We rode in silence for a few moments, and then I asked, are there many soldiers stationed in northwest Tibet? Not usually, he replied, except on the border or at the military bases. The problem is getting through the next 300 or 400 miles past Mount Kailash and Lake Manasarovar. There are several military checkpoints. For 4 hours, we rode without incident, traveling for a while on graded gravel roads, and then turning on the various dirt tracks for a time. We reached Saga without any difficulty and hit what Yen told me was the southern route into western Tibet. We passed mostly large transport trucks of local Tibetans in older cars or in carts. A few foreign hitchhikers could be seen around the truck stops. After another hour, Yen pulled the Jeep off the main road and onto what amounted to only a horse path. The Jeep bounced over deep gullies. There is usually a Chinese checkpoint up ahead on the main road, Yen said. We must go around. We were traveling up a steep slope, and when we got to the crest of the hill, Yen stopped the Jeep and led me to the edge of a cliff. Below us, several hundred feet away, we could see 2 large military trucks with Chinese insignia. Perhaps 12 soldiers were standing by the road. This is not good, Yen said. There are usually only a few soldiers at this crossroads. They may still be looking for us. I tried to shake off a rush of anxiety and keep my energy high. I thought I saw several of the soldiers looking up the hill towards us, so I ducked down.
"Something is happening," Yin whispered.
When I looked back at the crossroads, the soldiers were searching a van that had driven into the checkpoint. A middle-aged blonde man was standing on the side of the road being interrogated. Someone else was still in the van. We could just barely hear a European language being spoken, sounding very much like Dutch. "Why are they being detained?" I asked Yen.
"I don't know," he said. "They may not have the correct permits, or perhaps they asked the wrong questions."
I lingered, wishing I could help.
"Please," Yen said, "we must go."
We got in the jeep, and Yin drove slowly around the rest of the hill and down the slope on the other side. At the bottom, we hit another narrow track that turned to the right, away from the crossroads, still heading northwest. We traveled on this road for about 5 more miles, before it merged back into the main road and into Zhangba, a small town with several hotels and a few shops. Here, there were people walking, leading yaks and other livestock, and several Land Cruisers drove by.
"We are now just one of the pilgrims heading to Mount Kailash," Yin said. "We will be less noticeable."
I wasn't convinced. In fact, half a mile farther, a Chinese military truck pulled onto the road directly behind us, and another surge of fear ran through me. Yin turned onto a side street, and the truck moved past us and out of sight.
"You must stay strong," Yin said. "It is time for you to learn the second extension."
He went on to guide me through the first extension again until I could visualize and feel my energy flowing out in front of us and into the distance.
"Now that you have your energy moving out, you must set this field of energy to have a certain effect."
His comment fascinated me.
"Set my field?"
"Yes.
We can direct our prayer field to act on the world in various ways. We do this by using our expectations. You have already done this once, remember? Han taught you to expect that the energy would keep flowing through you. Now you must set your field with other expectations and do so with true discipline. Otherwise, all your energy can quickly collapse in fear and anger."
He looked at me with a sad expression I had never seen before.
"What's wrong?" I asked. "When I was young, I watched a Chinese soldier kill my father. I hate and fear them intensely, and I must confess something. I myself am part Chinese. This is the worst part. It is this memory and guilt that erodes my energy so that I tend to anticipate the worst. You will learn that at these higher levels of energy, our fields of prayer act very quickly to bring us exactly what we expect. If we fear, it brings to us what we fear. If we hate, it brings us more of what we hate. Thankfully, when we go into these negative expectations, our prayer fields collapse rather quickly because we lose our connection with the divine and are no longer outflowing love. But a fear expectation can still be powerful. That is why you must monitor your expectations carefully and set your field consciously."
He smiled at me and added,
"Because you don't hate the Chinese military the way I do, you have an advantage. But you still have much fear, and you seem to be capable of great anger, just like me. Perhaps that is why we are together."
I was looking ahead at the road as we drove, thinking about what Yin was saying, not believing that our thoughts could be that powerful. My reverie was interrupted when Yin slowed the jeep and parked in front of a line of dusty frame buildings.
"Why are you stopping?" I asked.
"Won't we draw more attention to ourselves this way?"
"Yes," he said, "but we must risk it. The soldiers have spies everywhere, but we have no choice. It is not safe to go into the western areas of Tibet with only one vehicle. There are no places to make repairs. We must find someone to go with us."
"What if they turn us in?"
Yin looked at me in horror. "That won't happen if we get the right people. Watch your thoughts.
I told you we have to set the right field around us. It is important. He started to get out of the car but hesitated. You must do better than me in this regard or we have no chance. Focus on setting your field for Rectenbrell. I was silent for a moment.
Rectenbrell? What's that?
It is the Tibetan word for synchronicity. You must set your field to stay in the synchronistic process, to bring the intuitions, the coincidences to help us.
Yen glanced at the building and got out of the jeep, indicating with his hand that he wanted me to stay. For almost an hour, I waited, watching the Tibetan people walk by. Occasionally, I would see someone who looked Indian or European. At one point, I even thought I saw the Dutchman we had seen at the checkpoint pass on a distant street. I strained to see, but I couldn't be sure.
Where was Yen? I wondered.
The last thing I needed was to be separated again. I imagined myself driving through this town all alone, lost, having no idea where to go. What would I do? Finally, I saw Yen leave the building. For a moment he hesitated, looking both ways carefully before walking to the jeep.
I found two people I know, he said as he climbed behind the wheel. I think they will do.
He was trying to be convincing, but his tone of voice betrayed his doubt. He started up the car and we drove on. 5 minutes later, we passed a small restaurant made entirely from corrugated tin. Yen parked the jeep about 200 feet from the restaurant, hiding it behind some oil storage tanks. We were on the outskirts of town now, and almost no one was on the street. Inside the building, we found one room with 6 rickety tables. A narrow, whitewashed bar separated us from the kitchen, where several women worked. One of the women saw us sit down and came over to us. Yen spoke briefly to her in Tibetan, and I caught the word for soup. The woman nodded and looked at me. The same, I said to Yen, taking off my coat and draping it behind me on the chair. And water. Yen translated, and the woman smiled and walked away. Yen turned serious. Did you understand what I said earlier? You must now set a field that brings more synchronicity. I nodded. How do I set that field? The first thing you must do is make sure you build on the first extension. Be certain the energy is flowing into you and out into the world. Feel the measures. Set your expectation for this energy to be constant. Now, you must expect that your prayer field will act to bring forth just the thoughts and events necessary for your best destiny to unfold. In order to set this field around you, you must keep yourself in a state of conscious alertness.
Alert? For what?
For synchronicity. You must keep yourself in a state where you are constantly looking for the next mysterious bit of information that helps you toward your destiny. Some synchronicity will come to you no matter what you do, but you can increase the occurrence if you set a constant field by always expecting it. I reached into my back pants pocket for my notebook. Although I hadn't used it before, I had an intuition to make note of what Yen was saying. Then I remembered that I had left the notebook in the jeep.
It's locked, he said, handing me the keys with a nod of his head. Don't go anywhere else.
I went straight to the jeep and retrieved the notebook, and was about to head back when the sound of vehicles pulling up to the restaurant startled me. I moved back behind the tanks and looked out at the scene. In front of the restaurant were 2 gray Chinese-built trucks. 5 or 6 men in plain clothes got out of the trucks and went into the restaurant. From where I was, I could see inside through the windows. The men lined everyone up against the walls and began to search them. I tried to locate Yen, but I couldn't see him anywhere.
Did he escape?
A new Land Cruiser pulled up outside, and a tall, lanky Chinese official in a military uniform got out and walked toward the door. He was clearly the man in charge. At the door, he looked inside briefly, then stopped and turned around, looking up both sides of the street as though sensing something. He turned my way, and I ducked behind the bins again, my heart racing. After a moment, I risked a glance toward the restaurant. The Chinese were bringing out the people and loading them into the trucks. Yen wasn't among them. One of the cars drove away as the officer in charge spoke to the remaining men. He seemed to be directing them to search the street. I ducked around the tanks and took a large breath. I knew if I stayed there, it would only be a matter of time before they found me. Looking for options, I noticed a narrow dirt alleyway that ran from the tanks through to the next street. I jumped into the jeep, put it into neutral, and used the small incline of the street to roll through the alley, turning right on the next corner. I started the car, but had no idea where I was going. All I wanted to do was put some distance between me and the soldiers. After a few blocks, I took a left onto a narrow lane which took me into an area that had few buildings. 100 more yards, and I seemed to be completely out of town. A mile later, I pulled off the road and parked behind a cluster of high rocky mounds, each the size of a house. Now what? I thought. I was completely lost, with absolutely no idea where to go. A flash of anger and frustration raced through me. Yen should have prepared me for this possibility. Probably someone he knew in town could help me, but I had no way to find anyone now. A flock of crows landed on the mound to my right, then flew up over the jeep and circled, cawing loudly. I looked out the windows in both directions, certain that someone was disturbing the birds, but I saw no one. After a few minutes, most of the crows flew toward the west, still cawing, but one stayed at the top of the mound, silently looking in my direction. That's good, I thought. He can be a sentry. I could stay put until I decided what to do. In the back of the jeep, I found some dried fruit and nuts along with some crackers. I ate them unconsciously, taking occasional nervous drinks from the canteen of water. I knew I had to devise a plan. It came to me to head further up the road to the west, but I decided against it. A great fear was overwhelming me now, and I wanted only what I had desired all along, to forget about this trek and get back to Lhasa and then to the airport. I knew I could remember some of the turns, but the others I would have to guess at. I couldn't believe I hadn't tried to call someone at Lama Rigdon's monastery or later at Han's to set up an escape plan. As I thought about what to do, my heart froze. I could hear the first rumblings of a vehicle coming down the road in my direction. I thought about starting the jeep and pulling away, but realized the vehicle was closing too fast. Instead, I grabbed the canteen and a sack of food, ran behind the farthest mound, and hid in a place where I was out of sight but could still see what was happening. The vehicle slowed down. As it pulled up even with me, I realized it was the van we had seen earlier at the roadblock. The driver was the blonde man whom the Chinese soldiers had been interrogating, and in the passenger seat was a woman. As I watched, they slowed the van to a complete stop and began to talk. I thought about going out and talking to them, but immediately felt a flash of fear. What if the soldiers had alerted them about us, insisting that they be notified if we were seen? Would they turn me in? The woman opened her door slightly as though to get out, still talking with the man. Had they spotted the jeep? My mind was running wild. I decided that if she got out and came over, I would just start running. That way, they would only get the jeep, and I could put some distance between myself and this place before the officials came. With that thought in mind, I looked back at the van. The two were gazing toward the mound, an expression of concern on their faces. They looked at each other one more time before the woman slammed her door shut, and they sped away toward the west. I watched the van crest the small hill to my left and disappear. Somewhere inside me, I felt disappointed. Maybe they could have helped me, I thought. I considered running to the jeep and overtaking them, but I dismissed the idea. Better not to tempt fate, I concluded. It was more prudent to go back to my original plan and attempt to find my way back to Lhasa and home. After about a half hour, I returned to the jeep and started the engine. The crow, to my left, squawked and flew down the road in the direction the Dutch van had gone. I turned the other way and headed back towards Zhangba, taking a series of small roadways, hoping to bypass the main streets and the restaurant. I made it several more miles before I reached the top of a hill. I slowed the jeep as I crested the peak so that I could survey the long expanse of highway in the distance. When I got into a position to see, I was shocked. Not only was there a new roadblock set up half a mile down the mountain with dozens of soldiers, but I could count 4 big trucks and 2 jeeps filled with troops heading my way, closing fast. I quickly turned the jeep around and raced back in the direction I'd come, hoping they wouldn't see me. I knew I would be lucky to outpace them. I reasoned that I should travel farther west as fast as I could, then bear south and east. Perhaps there were enough small roads that I could get back to Lhasa that way. I darted across the main street and into a series of side roads, again heading south. I turned a curve and realized I was going the wrong way. I had inadvertently returned to the main road again. Before I could stop, I was less than 100 feet from another Chinese checkpoint. There were soldiers everywhere. I pulled over to the side of the road and put on the brake, then slid way down in the seat. Now what? I thought. Prison? What would they do to me? Would they think me a spy? After a few moments, I noticed that the Chinese seemed oblivious to my presence, even though I was parked in plain sight. Old cars and carts, and even pedestrians on bikes kept passing me, and the soldiers would stop them all and ask for identification, checking their papers and sometimes searching them. Yet they paid me no attention at all. I glanced to the right and realized that I was parked just short of a driveway that led up to a small stone house several hundred feet away. To the left of the house was a small lawn of uncut grass, and beyond the grass, I could see another street. Just at that moment, a large truck drove past and stopped right in front of me, blocking my view of the checkpoint. Moments later, a blue Toyota Land Cruiser driven by another blonde man came up and pulled around the truck. Next, I heard loud talking and shouts in Chinese. The vehicle seemed to be backing up as if to try to turn around, but the soldiers swarmed it. Although my line of sight was blocked, I could hear angry shouts in Chinese interspersed by fearful pleas in English that carried a Dutch accent. "No, please," the voice said. "I'm sorry. I'm a tourist. Look, I have a special license to drive on the road." Another car pulled up. My heart leaped in my chest. It was the same Chinese official I'd seen at the restaurant earlier. I slipped farther down in my seat, trying to hide as he walked right past me. "Give me your papers," he asked the Hollander in perfect English. As I listened, I noticed something move to my right and peered through the passenger window to see what it was. The driveway down toward the house appeared to be bathed in a warm, luminous glow, the exact same glow I had witnessed when Yin and I had escaped just outside Lhasa. The Dakini. The Jeep was idling, so all I had to do was pull slowly to the right and down the drive. I was barely breathing as I passed the house and drove through the grass to the next street and turned left. A mile farther, I turned left again, heading north out of town on the side street I had taken earlier. 10 minutes later, I was back at the mounds, pondering what to do. Down the road to the west, I heard another crow call. Instantly, I decided to head in that direction, the way I could have been traveling all along. The road led up a steep rise, crested, and then settled into a long straightaway along the rocky plain. I drove for several hours as the afternoon light began to fade. There were no cars or people to be seen anywhere, and almost no houses. Half an hour later, it was completely dark, and I was thinking about finding a place to pull over for the night when I noticed a narrow gravel drive heading off to my right. I slowed the Jeep and looked more closely. There was something just to the side of the driveway. It looked like an item of clothing. I stopped the Jeep and shined a flashlight out through the window. It was a parka. My parka! The one I had left in the restaurant just before the Chinese had come. Smiling, I switched off the light. Yin must have placed my jacket here. I got out of the Jeep, picked it up, and drove up the narrow road with the headlights off. The drive led about a half a mile up a gradual incline to a small house and barn. I drove cautiously. Several goats looked at me from across a fence. On the porch of the house, I noticed a man sitting on a stool. I stopped the Jeep and he stood up. I knew that silhouette. It was Yin. I got out of the Jeep and ran up to him. He met me in a stiff embrace, smiling. "I am glad to see you," he said. "You see, I said you were being helped." "I was almost caught," I replied. "How did you get away?" A nervousness returned to his face. "The women at the restaurant are very cunning. They saw the Chinese officers and hid me in the oven. No one ever looked in there." "What do you think will happen to the women?" I asked. He met my eyes, but said nothing for a long moment. "I do not know," he replied. "Many people are paying a high price for helping us." He looked away and pointed to the jeep. Help me bring in some food, and we'll make something to eat.
As Yen made a fire, he explained that after the police had left, he had gone back to his friend's house, and they had suggested this old house as a place for him to stay while they looked around for another vehicle.
I knew that you might become overwhelmed by fear and try to get back to Lhasa, Yen added. But I also knew that if you decided to continue on this journey, you would eventually try to head northwest again. This was the only road, so I placed your jacket there, hoping it would be you who saw it, and not the soldiers.
That was quite a risk, I said. He nodded as he put the vegetables in a heavy boiler filled with several inches of water and hung it on the metal hook over the fire to steam. Yak dung flames lapped at the bottom of the pan. Seeing Yen again seemed to take much of my fear away. As we sat down in old dusty chairs by the fire, I said, I have to admit that I did try to get away. I thought it was my only chance to survive. I went on to tell him everything that had happened, everything, that is, except the experience of the light around the house. When I got to the part where I was in the mounds and the van came by, he sat up in his chair.
You are sure it was the same van we saw at the road drop? He asked pointedly.
Yes, it was them, I replied.
He looked totally exasperated. You saw the people we had seen before and you didn't speak with them? His face had an edge of anger. Don't you remember me telling you about my dream, about us meeting someone who could help us find the gateway?
I didn't want to take a chance that they would report me, I protested.
What? He stared at me, then leaned over and held his face in his hands for a moment.
I was petrified, I said. I can't believe I've gotten myself in this situation. I wanted out. I wanted to survive.
Listen to me closely, Yen said. The chances of your getting out of Tibet now by fleeing are very slim. Your only chance of surviving is to go forward, and to do that, you have to use the synchronicity.
I looked away, knowing he was probably right.
Tell me what happened when the van approached, Yen said. Every thought, every detail.
I told him the van had stopped, and when it did, I immediately grew afraid. I described how the woman acted, as if she wanted to get out, but changed her mind, and they left.
He shook his head again. You killed the synchronicity with a misuse of your prayer field. You set your field with fearful expectations, and it stopped everything.
I looked away.
Think about what was happening, Yen continued. When you heard the van approaching, you had two choices. You could have thought about that occurrence as a threat or as a potential aid. Certainly, you have to consider both, but once you recognized the van, that should have told you something. The fact that it was the same van that we had seen earlier at the crossroads is meaningful, especially since these same people created the diversion that allowed us to go by without being seen. From that point of view, they had already helped you and now were there to possibly help you again.
I nodded. He was right. Clearly, I had blown it. Yen looked away, distracted by his own thoughts, then said,
You completely lost your energy and positive expectation. Remember what I told you at the restaurant? Setting a field for synchronicity is a matter of putting yourself in a particular state of mind. It is easy to think about synchronicity intellectually, but unless you enter the state of mind where your prayer field will help, all you will do is glimpse the coincidences every once in a while. In some situations, that is enough. And you will be led forward for a time, but eventually, you will lose your direction. The only way to establish a constant flow of synchronicity is to stay in a state where your prayer field keeps this flow moving toward you, a state of conscious alertness. I'm still not sure how to get into this state of mind. One must stop and remind oneself to assume an attitude of alertness every moment. One must visualize that one's energy is going out and bringing just the right hunches to you, the right events. You have to expect them to occur at any moment. We set our fields to bring us synchronicity by being ever vigilant, always expecting the next encounter. Every time you forget to keep yourself in this state of expectation, you must catch yourself and remember. The more you stay in this state of mind, the more the synchronicity will increase, and eventually, if you keep your energy high, this posture of conscious alertness will become your prevailing attitude toward life. The legends say the prayer extensions will eventually be second nature to us. We will set them in the morning as routinely as getting dressed. That is the place you must reach. The state of mind where you have this expectation constantly. He paused and looked at me for a moment. When you heard the vehicle coming toward you, you immediately went into fear. From the sounds of it, they were intuiting that they should stop at the mounds, although they probably had no idea why. But when you went into fear, thinking that they were possibly the bad guys, your field actually went out and had an effect on them, entering their field and probably making them feel something was amiss, that they were doing something wrong. So, they took off. What he was telling me was fantastic, but it felt true to me. Tell me more about how our fields affect people, I said. He shook his head. You're getting ahead of yourself. The effect of our fields on other people is the third extension. For now, just concentrate on setting a field for synchronicity and not going into fearful thoughts. You have a tendency to expect the worst. Remember, when we were on our way to Lama Rigdon and I left you alone, you saw a group of refugees and they would have led you right to the Lama's monastery if you had only talked to them. But instead, you figured they were going to turn you in, and you missed the synchronicity. This negative thinking is a pattern with you. I just looked at him, feeling tired. He smiled and didn't mention any of my mistakes again. We talked casually about Tibet for most of the evening, going outside at one point to look up at the stars. The sky was clear and the temperature barely freezing. Above us were the brightest stars I had ever seen, and I commented to Yen about it. Of course they look big, he said. You are standing on the rooftop of the world. The next morning, I slept late and went through a series of Tai Chi movements with Yen. We waited as long as we could for Yen's friends, but they never showed up. We realized we'd have to risk going with only one car after all and loaded up the jeep, pulling out right at noon. Something must have happened, Yen said, looking over at me. He was trying to be strong, but I could tell he was worried. We were heading up the main road again through a thick, sand-blown haze that had covered most of the landscape and obscured our view of the mountains. It will be hard for the Chinese to see us in this, Yin remarked. That's good, I said. I had been wondering how the Chinese knew we had been at the restaurant in Zhangba, so I asked Yin what he thought. I'm sure it was my fault, he said. I told you how much anger and fear I felt toward them. I'm sure my prayer field was bringing me what I was asking for. I looked hard at him. This was too much. Are you telling me, I asked, that because you were fearful, your energy went out and somehow brought the Chinese to us? No, not merely the fear. We all get a general kind of fear. That's not what I mean. I'm talking about letting my mind go into fearful visions of what might happen, what the Chinese might do. I've seen them operate in Tibet for so long, I know their methods. I know how they oppress individuals through intimidation. I allowed myself to see them coming for us in my mind as a little vision, and I wasn't doing anything to counteract that image. I should have caught myself and envisioned in my mind that they would no longer be so antagonistic toward us, and then held that expectation. My fear, in general, was not what brought them. I went unconscious and held a specific image, a specific expectation that they would come in on us. That was the problem. If you hold a negative image too long, it can eventually come true. I was still on by the whole idea. Could this be correct? For a long time, I had observed that people who feared a particular event, a burglary at their house, for instance, or getting a particular disease, or losing a lover, often experienced just that occurrence in their lives. Was this the effect Yin was describing?
I remembered the fearful image I'd had earlier in Zhangba, when Yin had left to find someone to go with us. I had imagined being alone in the jeep, driving around, lost, which is exactly what had ended up happening. A chill went through me. I had been making the same mistake as Yin. Are you saying that everything that happens to us that's negative is the result of our own thoughts? I asked. He frowned. Of course not. Many things merely happen in the natural course of living with other human beings. Their expectations and actions play a part too. But we do have some creative influence whether we want to believe it or not. We have to wake up and understand that in terms of our prayer energy, an expectation is an expectation, whether it is based on fear or faith. In this case, I wasn't monitoring myself closely enough. I told you my hatred of the Chinese was a problem. He turned and our eyes met. Also, remember what I told you, he added, that at these higher levels of energy, the effect of our prayer field is very quick. Out there in the ordinary world, individuals still have a mix of fear images and success images, so they tend to cancel each other out and keep the effect low. But at these levels, we can affect what happens very quickly, even though a fear image will eventually collapse the strength of our field. The key is to make sure your mind is focused on the positive path of your life, not on some fearful expectation. That's why the second extension is so important. If we make sure we stay in a state of conscious alertness for the next synchronicity, our minds stay on the positive and off our fear and doubt. Do you see what I mean? I nodded, but said nothing. Yin focused again on the road. We have to use this power right now. Stay as alert as you can. We could pass the van very easily in this haze, and we don't want to miss them. You're sure they were heading in this direction? Yes, I said. Then, if they stopped to spend the night the way we did, they couldn't be that far ahead. All morning we traveled, still heading northwest. As much as I tried to keep it up, I couldn't stay in the state of conscious alertness Yin was describing. Something wasn't right. Yin noticed and kept looking over at me. Finally he turned and said, Are you sure you're expecting the full synchronistic process? Yeah, I replied. I think so. He frowned slightly and continued to glance over at me. I knew what he was getting at. Both in Peru and later in the Appalachians with the 10th Insight, I'd experienced the process to synchronicity. Each of us at any one point has a primary question about our lives, something we are inquiring into given our particular life situation. In our case, the question was how we might find the Dutch van, and then Will, and the gateway. Ideally, once we recognize the central question in our lives, we will have a guiding thought or an intuition about how to answer it. We find ourselves with a mental image that would suggest going somewhere, taking some action, saying something to a stranger. Again, ideally, if we follow that intuition, coincidence will occur to give us information pertaining to our question. This synchronicity leads us further down our life path and, in turn, to a new question. What do the legends say about this? I asked. They say, Yin replied, that humans will eventually learn that their prayer power can greatly influence the flow of their lives. By using the force of our expectations, we can bring forth the process of synchronicity more frequently. But we have to stay alert for the whole process, beginning with the next intuition. Are you consciously expecting an intuition?
I haven't gotten anything yet, I said.
But are you expecting one? He pressed.
I don't know. I wasn't really thinking about intuitions.
He nodded. You must remember that this is part of setting your field of prayer for synchronicity. You must stay alert and expect the whole process to come forth. The question, getting an intuition and following it, and looking for the coincidences. Remind yourself to expect it all. Be alert for it all, and if you do, your energy will go out ahead of you and help bring the flow. He shot me a smile, meant to uplift my spirits. I took in a few breaths, feeling my energy begin to return. Yin's mood was contagious. My alertness sharpened. I smiled back at him. I was, for the first time, appreciative of who Yin was. At times, he was as fearful as me, and often he was too blunt, but his heart was into this journey, and he wanted more than anything to succeed. As I thought about this, I slipped into a daydream of Yin and me walking through rocky sand dunes at night, somewhere near a river. There was a glow in the distance, a campfire that we wanted to reach. Yin was leading, and I was glad to follow. I looked over at him again. He was staring hard at me. I realized what had happened. "I think I just got something," I said. "I had the thought of us walking toward a campfire. Do you think that means anything?"
"Only you would know," he said.
"But I don't know. How am I supposed to know?"
"If your thought was a guiding intuition, it would have something to do with us looking for the van. Who was at the campfire?